Hello, and welcome to the April edition of the Cinetopia radio show and podcast. I'm Amanda, your host, and on this show, show regular Clara Strachan and I talk four films currently out in cinemas. First up is Alex Garland's highly anticipated film,
Civil War.
Next, Dev Patel's first foray into directing with Monkey Man. Next up is Ryusuke Hamaguchi's Evil Does Not Exist. And finally, we review Simon Chambers' documentary, Much Ado About Dying. So Cinetopia has quite a few events coming up in the next few weeks that we're very excited to share with you and hope you'll join if you're in the Edinburgh area. So our next Cinetopia doc screening is this Wednesday, the 17th of April at Cameo Cinema. And it's the second film as part of our strand, Unreeling Dreams. So the film is Cemetery of Cinema. And it's a story about another film, Muramani, which was considered the first film ever to be made by an African French-speaking director. However, no one knows where to find the print or even if one exists, and director Tiano Solomon Diallo embarks on a quixotic quest to trace back the film in the hopes that he will eventually find a print. After our screening, you could hear from director Diallo, who did a pre-recorded interview with us as he discusses the importance of cinema and the complex issues surrounding archives in a post-colonial society. It's a really fantastic film, and I really hope you'll join us for that. Also, this month, our networking is back at the Home Bar on the 24th of April from 7 to 10 p.m. We're running this in collaboration with the Sci Fan Festival, which runs from the 25th of April to the 12th of May. You can find out more about that festival on sci-fan.org. And if you've not been to a Cinetopia networking night before, this is one of our regular nights for the general film industry to get together for a casual drink or chat. So it's always good fun, so please join us. Finally, coming up on the 3rd and 4th May, we are doing a celebration of Kieslowski's Tricolor films in collaboration with the French Institute and the Center for Open Learning. So we're sharing blue, white, and red across 2 days, and you can find all that information on our website as well as on the French Institute website. So all of this can be found, tickets and more information on our website at cinetopia.co.uk. So hope to see you at one of those events. So welcome to our April edition of Cinetopia Radio Show and Podcast. I'm here with Clara. Clara, how are you? It's a sunny day, but we've been seeing lots of films. It's not been very sunny recently, so it's just about the weather's turning in Edinburgh. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Well, I'm really amped up because I've seen, there's a common theme, there's a common thread in all of the films that we've seen. There's a lot of gore, there are bloodbaths, and there's a lot of death, but there's a lot of righteous justice meted out. So yeah, I'm feeling kind of amped up.
You're right. When you said common theme, I was waiting to see what you meant. Now I can see it all.
There's a theme of rebellion. There's a deep rebellion running through all these films, I feel.
Yeah. So we are, we're going to review four films, and we're going to start with the first one, which is probably the big blockbuster of this weekend, and it's Civil War.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Let me know if you want to try anything on.
Are you guys aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on all across America?
We just try to stay out. With what we see on the news, seems like it's for the best.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
Mr. President, do you regret the use of airstrikes against American citizens?
We're moving to D.C. today.
We need to go down there.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol.
Every instinct in me says this is death.
What if...
Every time I survived the war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What?
Are you American?
okay?
Okay. What kind of American are you?
And yeah, we both saw it in the cinemas, of course. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about it. But why don't you tell us about Civil War?
Yeah, so Civil War is, I suppose, hotly anticipated because it does feel like such a zeitgeist movie. It feels like someone who's made a film about the thing that everyone's been sort of like muttering under their breath that may happen. And maybe the culmination of the nightmarish politics and sort of events that have been happening the last 4 years. So interesting to see someone actually try and put that into a film and try and sort of compact that into a couple hours and see how they handle that. So I think, yeah, a lot of people were on the fence about whether or not this was going to be handled correctly, if it was going to, which camp it would fall in. But anyway, what we have is a story about a dystopian near future in America in which a civil war has broken out between two secessionist states. The wild cards of Texas and California have teamed up to take down the fascistic American president and government. The fascistic president being Nick Offerman, who is going for a third term, because why not? Because he can, I guess. The story follows a ragtag team of journalists of varying stripes, colors, and levels of experience as they try and cross America to get that all-important interview with the president as his regime crumbles. It's a gory film. It's a dramatic film. It's a bloodbath. It always said it was going to be, and that's what we got. I was really interested in seeing this once I'd read a lot of reviews. I only wanted to go after I'd read a lot of reviews, but specifically Google reviews. My favorite thing is to go to the 5 stars and then read the 1 stars immediately after, or vice versa, like the lay of the land. And they did not disappoint. So just to share a couple of those for you, Gwen. So 1 star reviews. Quote, the trailers were a lie. people are still pissed that the trailer is not giving them the entire plot. And the next one, quote, this movie is an insult to the American military more than anything else.
Oh boy.
Other professional reviewers have said things like it's just decontextualized violence, criticized it, saying, you know, was it necessary to introduce and then sacrifice two non-white characters to score a point about racism that lurks in American heartland? So people have really picked this apart. People have wanted this film to be what they want it to be. They want it to come down on a side. People are projecting a lot of meanings onto it. For example, I saw one film critic went on Twitter and was like sharing some thoughts about it, which, you know, you're going to get dragged if you go on Twitter and say anything. But like, so she was really in for it. But she's a black film critic, black American film critic, talking about the film. And then people were dragging her and saying, like, how dare you paint a film which glorifies neo-Nazism in this light, which is outrageous. When you watch it, it doesn't actually fall down any particular political side. But that just shows you how hot this topic is and how volatile this topic is. People are projecting the freedom fight that they want to see onto this film.
I mean, I the one thing I did like about it is the very beginning that it did feel like it wasn't, it took the politics out of it. And yet there's so much, there's so much politics there, but that when you put Texas and California in the same Western front, if you will, you don't know what side they're on or what, you know, or whatnot, then it doesn't make it very specific to the politics that is the ongoing unrest right now that is in America. So I appreciated that. But yeah, I think I've heard there's great a deal of controversy around this film because it doesn't pick a side. That's what I've heard.
Filmic verisimilitude is something which is always going to irk people. People are always going to say either it wasn't true to the story, or why haven't you tried to reach this reality, or it was too removed from reality. It really does go to show that expectations, people have so many expectations about certain kinds of films and certain themes in films. Yeah, it's just super fascinating. A lot of people are annoyed about the political neutrality element. So there's a lot of name drops in the film that allude to specific factions and violence, but there is no value judgment made or no explanation given to anything that's happening. So for example, there's a mention of something like the Antifa massacre, but does not say whether Antifa was the perpetrator or the victim in that paradigm. So, but then I've read reviews, people have written say, and they're outraged. They're outraged that he's imagining a future in which Antifa are living up to the right-wing paranoia fantasy that, you know, they are the dangerous faction, they're the dangerous militia that is going to, you know, be the downfall of America. People are annoyed about it, but actually he doesn't fall down his side. I think it's a dark mirror that is being held up to the audience at this point in time. But I think, yeah, a lot of people are annoyed as well that it doesn't fit into the paradigm of an action film necessarily, in that it follows journalists. I think a lot of people are annoyed about that as well.
Also, people, I read a little bit about how egocentric journalists are or something like that.
And
they didn't like, I was like, all right. I mean, there's so many
reasons. Any American military film in the last 20 years, like, well.
There's so many reasons to complain about this film, I guess. But I guess the main question is, what did you think of the film?
Oh, well, so I went in trying to be really critical and wanted to not like it, but I really liked it. I just thought it was well done as well. Like, apart from anything else, apart from the fact that the story didn't land on anything that really irked me, which it could so easily have done, because I'm one of those people who, you know, when you see like an interview or an article and they're using buzzwords like populism, rise of populism, extreme, and just sort of throwing in buzzwords, which are actually really ill-defined political terms that can be sort of bandied about to bolster whatever kind of point you make. I thought I was going to dislike it, but I really loved it. I think it was fantastically made. I think the use of stock footage was really quite harrowing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are a lot of pieces of footage from civil unrest in America over the last couple of years. And there were some moments that just, yeah, it really takes you back. I was heavily involved in a lot of things that went on in that year, which came to violent ends, and I was hurt and like caught up in a bunch of things. So it was a bit like, there were some testy moments. So this was fun for me, going into a film about PTSD in journalism and then watching that kind of unfold, because yeah. that is where it goes. It is a psychological study of war from the perspective of a journalist. So it's just using the quote, well, the neutrality of journalists, the supposed neutrality of journalists, and the ambiguity of the sides, just to examine the hell that is war and the impact that can have on the psyche, and just how insane people can go, really. But yeah, I really liked it.
We'll talk a lot about pacing, but I think there was a point for all these films, but there was a point in the film at the beginning that I was like, this is kind of going a little slow. I'm not really totally freaked out yet. And I'm expecting with an Alex Garland kind of horror element to it or something like that. And then all of a sudden it does get really obviously intense. Like, so it totally changes it up. It took me a lot to kind of process the whole film this weekend, and also to, yeah, afterwards. I mean, I was very shook up. You felt like you were in the middle of it, which that's the point. And it was a very intense experience, and very scary, and also makes you think about so many things. Definitely, as you said, about war in general. So where we are presently and where we could be in a matter of time or whatnot, because you don't really get this idea of how farther in the future it is or in the past or whatnot, you know what I mean? So it feels very modern and yet dystopian at the same time.
So I think I saw an interview with Alex Garland that tried to explain why Texas and California, because initially when I heard that it was Texas and California that were the secessionist like rebel states, and then also Florida, worth a mention, wild card Florida, just like, you know, does its own thing as well. It's just a secessionist state all its own, which I love. But anyway, yeah, so Alex Garland was explaining why is the thing, because when I heard that, I was like, really? Like, what? Where is he going with this? I was very sort of like, oh, really? But yeah, he made the point that the fascistic government is so terrible that the two states overcome their own political divisions in service of overthrowing the larger issue, which is the government. So he points out that's the insanity, is that states and people at wider society aren't banding together to take on the larger threat and the broader threat of fascistic governments or you know, the powers that be, and are getting lost in infighting. And this is a common theme throughout a lot of the films today, which is really interesting to see, that we are in a zeitgeist moment in filmmaking where people are taking on these topics and they're becoming Hollywood blockbusters. Like the I think, I don't know what the figure stands at now, but I know that on the first day, Civil War took in 10.7 million at the box office. So it's popular. This isn't a fringe topic. This isn't a fringe thing. And
Yeah. But I suppose that's because it does, it is so, it can appeal to so many different people, and it does have this, yeah, really universal message. So aside from just saying that war is hell, it's also saying that war is like fentanyl and it's addictive. It's violence is addictive, and getting involved in these things is just, it's like a runaway train, which is why I liked it, because it was really maximalist and really unhinged and unrealistic in parts as well, as well as in other parts. So some battle scenes and some fight scenes are very realistic, and you're very much there, and it's kind of harrowing and disturbing how real it feels. But then you get these beautiful sequences which border on just black humor, just like full-on black comedy moments where you find yourself just like laughing in disbelief that you're actually watching certain things unfold.
What parts do you find
Okay, so we were laughing. I wasn't alone in this, but like, for example, there's after like probably one of the worst scenes in the film, the most harrowing scenes in the film. It suddenly cuts, and then there's like folk music, and it's like a folk music video, and they're driving through the burning forest, and there's sparks flying, and it's like, and then it does become poignant, but it is like a funny moment. Also, the last scene is very funny. So Suicide's Dream Baby Dream is playing for scenes of violence, and it's like, it's just so unbelievably cheeky of Alex Garland to look at like like an insurrection toppling the president of the United States, a bloody revolt, and then end the film in the bloodshed saying, "Dream, baby, dream."
Well, I was going to say the
Oh,
music was really fun in the film, and including the second that song started. It was, yeah, it was like, this song, really? That's how you end it? But yeah, I think the music overall was really fun. I do remember, like at around the in the 90s, there was, and why it maybe it's so popular is that, Hollywood tends to put these things out which are our greatest fears, or the things that are obviously, and we like to see that our fears happening, like on
yeah,
screen.
make them make rationalize it. We can play it out, we can investigate them safely. That, yeah, and
And
that's what I think it bothered people, because I don't think, because it didn't provide any kind of playbook or explanation to about the road to the Civil War or any of the conditions which, and that is a genuine criticism which I've seen leveled by really well-renowned critics, to which I just don't, which to which I say, why do you care? Like, why focus on what the movie isn't talking about? I don't know
yeah.
what people's obsession is with like focusing on a film's failures when it never promised to talk about, it's not a quote, it's not a serious film in the sense that it's looking at all the players, it's sitting in boardrooms, sitting in Senate conversations, looking at the power plays. It doesn't, it's not that. It's essentially, it's like a, it's a road movie more than anything else.
Yeah.
It's an apocalyptic road movie, pretty much.
Yeah. If you're trying to get those answers, you're not going to get them from here. And in the same way that I think there was a film that, what was the Julia Roberts film that was on Netflix or something, and where it was like
I
the
think it's the technological apocalypse one.
yeah that where people were very excited about that film as well, because it was supposed to, answer what could happen if,
I've never watched that.
but it ultimately also had a very similar sort of excitement from people who are like expecting the worst situation to happen. But in this way, such a better film because it doesn't explain anything necessarily. It's and that's what makes it interesting, what makes it comment so much on war and what this could be. And yeah, I mean, what it would look like to have another civil war, because we're talking, yeah,
Yes,
America's
actually.
done this before, so what this would look like now.
That's another interesting thing, is that it's this film doesn't so much focus on, it's not meant to focus on the upper echelons of either of the military sides. It doesn't bother with that, because the real glut of the drama and the horror and the tension is the wild card guerrilla fighters in the no man's lands between those points of control. And that's the most interesting thing, and that is the most horrible part about war, but also the most filmically interesting. So, like Apocalypse Now, they're the outliers, they're the rebels, they're the wild cards. They're just unpredictable, and that's where the intrigue lies. I was watching an interview on some kind of like carpet do that Garland did, and in the background there's the marketing for Civil War, and it's really Apocalypse Now coded. It's got, the helicopters over a sort of a hazy orange sunset over the city and some trees. And an in the interviewer commented on it and said, "Oh, I see Apocalypse Now references. How about that? Was that an influence?"
And then Garland seems a bit taken aback and seems and is a bit sort of like, oh God, I hope not. Because he says that Apocalypse Now is seductive. And as far as, you know, war films go, they're quite, it's quite seductive and almost romantic. And it's quite sort of, yeah, it's just, it's very thick and syrupy and hazy. And it is a romantic film in a way. And it's kind of like a rock and it's like a rock and roll film. It's gone down in the annals of film history is a little bit glamour. Yeah. And so he was saying that he'd hope that his inspirations from films such as Come and See, which decade was that in? Was that the 50s, 50s or 60s? Anyway, well, it's a post-war film, a Russian film, which was made about Nazi atrocities committed in the Russian countryside and across Europe. And it's definitely the most harrowing, one of the most harrowing films I've seen, definitely like top five, and I do not shy away from that subject matter at all. But he was citing film like that, which is staunchly on the side of vilifying war and presenting war as hell, which is why it's interesting that you were saying that the journalists were being that someone took to task the narcissism of the journalists involved. But that's kind of the point. It's meant to be like the ethical rot that sets in when you're just confronted day by day with documenting the worst atrocities in the world. So yeah, that was a fun arc. That was a fun little arc watching all the. So basically, the characters within Civil War. There's Kirsten Dunst's character, who's named after Lee Miller, like the famous war photographer who famously photographed Dachau after Hitler had slunk off into the background in defeat. The really iconic images. If you haven't seen them, you should check them out. But anyway, her character is based on Lee Miller. And then this sort of 20-something-year-old protege decides to tag along on one of the most dangerous journeys in America to try and learn the trade in the front lines. So we see Kirsten Dunst's character sort of suffer Pete from PTSD, and then crumble. And then we see the next generation coming up. So as soon as one person goes up in flames in PTSD, another one ignites underneath, and it is that sort of. It does document that those rolling generations of journalists who are inspired by previous journalists and then just go into the line of fire.
I was going to say, we could talk about the performances. And I really liked Kirsten Dunst in this role because it's not the way, well, it's an older Kirsten Dunst. It's not a Sofia Coppola. Speaking of Sofia Coppola, it's not a Sofia Coppola Kirsten Dunst. Marie Antoinette, but it's like a raw, like,
Leva,
kind of. No extra beauty products to, you know, I really liked her performance. And the young person that I don't forgot her name, but she is the person who's in Priscilla. So this was her first acting role before Priscilla. So both I think worked really well, although I have to say at the end I wasn't really into that moment, like, that I won't get to. Just like alluded to it.
And the culmination of their relationship.
Yes, the culmination of their relationship. I really didn't. That was the one part of this which it just me out.
I thought it was the cherry on the cake.
It's like, no, not that. But anyway, you'll have to watch it.
I was expecting that. And there's a dog in a film, you know, the dog's gonna die because, like, you need to, like, break people's hearts. I feel like there needs to be some kind of, like,
but
people just need to be rotten. People, like, in a film like this, like, people need to suffer. Like, they're gonna be horrible. It's just, yeah. I also so one of my favorite things to do, especially with a film like this, is just give it a cursory Google and then see the most inflammatory things that come up on Google, just that are perhaps by you know, some right wing publications or, you know, center right publications. And as usual, the Telegraph did not disappoint. The Telegraph's headline hot take on this movie was Alex Garland's Civil War, could it happen? Which I thought was a great in, which I thought was a really great in, and really, really covers a lot of misgivings people have about the film. The fact that it doesn't answer some of those really important questions, as we were saying. There is no front line that is really spoken about. The parameters in this film and the political parameters are really just not spoken about. There's an unknown front line, there's an unknown impact on the world, but I think Alex Garland really effectively alludes to the detriment and chaos that comes about with war. So, for example, there's a moment where they're negotiating at a gas station to try and buy some gas, and then Kirsten Dunst's character offers $300 and, you know, the guys don't bite. And then she says 300 Canadian and then they just, yeah, sure. Okay, fine.
Love that.
It's really great. I think so. There are little details in there which do ground it and make it a little bit more gritty and really, yeah, bring it back to reality a little bit. And I think he really does a fantastic job at both capturing the surreal, and there's really trippy elements in there, but also keeps it real. Because there's no sort of like Black Hawk Down action movie trope. For example, there is no grading on this film that would have you looking at the promotional material or a trailer and be like, oh, that's a dark apocalyptic action film. Mm. America looks gorgeous in this film. And I think that's really important to point out. The landscape is gorgeous. The sky is blue. The flowers are beautiful. And I think that really brings it home, is like the reality of war. And the reality of atrocities is they play out in the same world in which the most beautiful things happen and the most gorgeous things happen. And I think that makes it all the more harrowing, is that we're not trapped in the conventional action or dystopian universe per se. And that really brings it home. And I think that, again, grounds it a lot. I think, yeah, there's...
No, that's such a good point, because I thought about that too. I mean, obviously, like, as they're taking this trip from, I mean, the beginning is about taking a trip from New York to DC, and then it's like 900 miles, and I'm like, wait a minute, like, I've done that many times, like, how does that work? And then but through that is, yeah, I mean, America is, like you said, looks beautiful, and there are parts of it I'm like, how and where did they film this, and you know, what, how did they kind of take these sort of broken down, like, these spaces that have, you know, would have been vivacious. It grounded it in a way that America, the way America knows America, in the way that it was filmed. So I think that's a really good point, and I noticed that a lot.
Yeah, and I think I kept thinking back to the Telegraph's title of "Could It Happen Here," especially when the most harrowing scenes were happening. So, for example, there's a really visceral scene, which I think is mentioned in the trailers, and it's not a spoiler. They stop for gas, and then one of their the traveling party and the journalists looks, and they see bodies hanging in a sort of outhouse behind the garage, and then they go to investigate. And I just kept thinking, like, well, yeah, like, yeah, of course this is to happen. This is America. We're in living memory of, you know, public lynchings attended by a smiling public. It is possible. It's fully possible. Yeah, I think there's some beautiful moments. There's also some really obvious moments, but I think they worked well. I don't think I could really even fault them for that, even though I don't really like being like smacked over the head with a point. I feel like it gets away with it. For example, there's like a crashed helicopter outside a JCPenney, and then there's like the sports stadiums that are broken down and being repurposed as sort of like refugee camps. And, you know, these are like icons of the, like, American dream, the classic American dream. It's very much like a UK person is making this film about America. You can really see that. It's like the mall is rotting, or like, oh, the stadium is rotting, like, you know, the pillars of American society have really fallen. You know, different kinds of factionalism, like the sports teams have now become more political. But I just find it really interesting how he skirted the political issue. So, for example, Jesse Plemons' character is just really he's very much like the Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. He's just like full rogue character who just wants to watch the world burn and just wants to. He's
also, how about his glasses? Do you like these red glasses?
Interesting. Yeah, he's wearing like glasses, but these are the little touches which I was concerned that Alex Garland would go too hard on, because, you know, in the trailers, the trailers that lied, the trailers, I felt it was going to be like a really like, oh, Gen Z goes to war, oh, like, like, you know, because there was some scenes where there's a guy on the ground and he's holding an AK-47 and he's got like pastel pink nail polish on and he's got like dyed hair, and I was just like, oh man, I hope he's not going to go really hard on the, like, you know, bringing Gen Z and Gen X into war and really like hammering it home with those details. I kind of like the glasses. They were quite unhinged. I feel like they made it much more creepy. He's looking at the world through a red.
Well, that character was, the second I saw it, I was with my friend. I was like, is that Jesse Plemons? And then the glasses just still. And I think they, like, you can buy them now on like eBay or something like that.
Yeah, it's a good Halloween costume. My boyfriend leant over during the screening and was like, I can't believe this is how Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst met. Yeah, I just, that the conversations Jesse Plemons has, that's really, really interesting. So he's just sort of holding the journalist hostage and then sort of interrogating them to see if they fit with his politics or not, which is just makes for like the most horrific viewing. He asks the journalist, what kind of American are you? And I think that's a really interesting thing. So that he's quizzing them on where they're from, not even their political stance, just where they're from. I think that there's no context for this. You're as terrified about the answers as they are to give them. And I think that really works. So I think he skirts around the not giving the detail very well. I just think it works, personally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you bring up the thing about Canadian dollars, it just makes me think about, how unaware what America would think if they would become somebody like Argentina or something, where like our economy completely just spiraled out of control. And so overall, we'll definitely go back to see it again. I supposedly this IMAX experience would have, it was amazing as well, but I didn't see it in IMAX, so on a regular screen. But
I mean, I imagine that would make the, presidential vehicles and a hail of bullets feel as good to me as, some random dude seeing like Olympus Has Fallen. So I think that would be really fun. Would go see again.
It was great. It was frightening. It was a frightening road movie. It was still, I'm taking it all in. It's a film that, we'll be talking about and thinking about for a while, I'm sure.
Sequel.
All right, so Civil War, it's out in cinemas all over. I'm sure you won't be able to miss it, so go see it if you'd like.
Close your eyes and you will find yourself.
When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me a story of a demon king and his army. They brought fire and terror to the land. Until they faced the protector of the people, the White Monkey.
There you are. You are a beast.
Clara, you saw another film today that you wanted to talk a little bit about, another blockbuster, if you will.
I'm in the mood for bloodbath blockbusters, it seems. And it's it's doing me good, man. I've really got the blood pumping. It's been cathartic. Who needs therapy? Yes. So this Monkey Man, I decided to go see Monkey Man and convinced Amanda to let me speak about Monkey Man because I was in the pub with my friends the other night and it came up and I was just like, you know what? The people want to know about Monkey Man. People are curious about Monkey Man. And rightly so. So this is Dev Patel's directorial debut. And it's a bloodbath action revenge film, which goes beyond the lone wolf archetype of the genre and sort of bleeds into a film about mythology, class consciousness, rebellion, insurrection. And it ends up being a Trojan horse of a film that delivers revenge catharsis, but motivated by really weighty social justice issues without being dry or preachy. It's really fun film. And it's a really well-made film for his directorial debut. I think he should be really proud of it. It's good fun. Like as violent as it is and as much as it deals with some really heavy themes and has a lot of tragedy involved, a lot of trauma involved, it's really fun. And it's just a good time. So Patel actually describes this film as a love letter to his mom, among other things, which is really interesting. And that theme actually really does come out. There's a lot of feminist themes in here, which are subtly interwoven, which I really loved. I feel like Dev Patel hit so many points with this film. He takes so many harmed underdog people with him on this hero's journey. And Dev Patel's character, who is known as just like the kid, and he's like sort of just eponymous. He's the eponymous Monkey Man, who fights in underground boxing matches, who's come from a history of serious trauma and pain and suffering, which drives the revenge plot. He becomes a sort of hero of the people. And from the depths of trauma, this one man comes to fight for others, which is a comment that Patel has made to several interviewees and really wanted to bring to the fore. He wanted to make a sort of Trojan horse political film about not fighting each other, but for each other. And he heard a really brilliant philosophical remark by an Indian poet, and I can't remember his name, but the quote is, "The pain will leave you once it's finished teaching you." So this is more, this film incorporates a lot of different elements from different films, but Dev Patel has been really clear about not wanting it to really be compared, because he says it's just sort of a mashup of the things between his ears, which I really see. I think it's really unique. It takes different elements from traditional martial arts films, and also more modern action films from Asian directors, especially Korean films. So he cites Enter the Dragon and The Raid as really heavy influences. And I think, yeah, it takes that. It takes different elements and uses them really well, puts it to its disposal. So it takes a lot of tropes. For example, you know, the stereotype of the hero is almost defeated and then he goes and then he is trained and then recuperates and becomes even stronger because he taps into his you know, the more emotional, psychological issues that he's undertaking, yeah, to come back again. You get that, but it doesn't feel, if you're aware that it's like a tongue-in-cheek, like wink, nudge reference, but it's enjoyable. So Patel commented saying that he wanted his Mr. Miyagi to be a Hydra person. So Hydra are a really historically marginalized group of people that are transgender, intersex, or eunuchs. Always pushed to the margins of society, but have also inhabited this really important space in culture and society where they represent the personification and the melding of two different spirits. So like the devotional element of feminine energy and then the destructive element of male energy in one. So they're very interesting group of people, and they fit really well with the narrative. And Patel then takes these the grievances that a lot of downtrodden people have been, you know, been victim to at the hands of the government, at the hands of charlatan religious preachers, various other parties, and takes them with him on a revenge journey. It's really beautiful, actually. It's actually really good, despite the fact that there's the most gory and insane kills I've ever seen, including The Raid. I mean, The Raid is brilliant fight choreography, but the fight choreography in this is so, so good. And the cinematography is fantastic. He has some really creative, he took really creative angles with this, and it really paid off. So actually, one of the one-star reviews that I saw for Monkey Man was, the cinematography is really terrible. It's shaky the whole time. So this this guy thinks it isn't actually a directorial choice, but it very much was, if that person is listening to this. There's a lot of handheld cameras, and there's a couple of shots that Dev Patel spoke about where a camera is literally swung around on a rope in a crowd, and it's in a celebrating Diwali crowd, and then it's grabbed by someone, and then someone runs to the crowd. So he says that from the obstacles in production came a lot of great opportunities, and you really see that. So for example, he used a stuntman as a cameraman. So he gave him a camera, and then the stuntman was getting in the action and was choreographed into a lot of the fight scenes. So it makes it really claustrophobic and really intense. There's really claustrophobic and kinetic energy to a lot of the shots, which are really, really impactful. It's so slick, and it's just really enjoyable to watch. There's like a sort of a Wong Kar-wai kind of like voyeuristic style to a lot of it as well. And the same with like the color and the tone and the pace of it. It's very like energetic. The sound really carries the film as well, which I think Dev Patel said was like a homage to Bollywood and Indian film's obsession with like dance numbers and musical scenes and music. So really music heavy, really music driven, really intense. And cathartic, like watching a rapist and corrupt evil henchman get beaten to death with like a sparkly shoe or like a farming scythe is really like thrilling as it is cathartic. Yeah.
You have me torn, because I want to see it now that you've described it, except this whole bloody
where there's moments where I was like, he's done it.
And Civil War did that a lot for me this weekend too. So I might give myself a week before I go to another bloodbath of a film. So Monkey Man sounds good. We'll check it out. That's Monkey Man, currently in cinemas.
そうだ。鹿の食べた後。
昨日急に来られてさ、驚いたよ。
水口と原沢にグランピング施設の管理、運営をいたします。
So, the next film we're going to review is in some cinemas currently, Evil Does Not Exist, Japanese film. Clara, why don't you tell us about this film?
So Evil Does Not Exist is a film directed by Ryosuke Hamaguchi, apologies if I'm butchering that, probably am, who previously directed Drive My Car. I believe that did very well. A lot of people saw Drive My Car. This film has also done extremely well. I believe it was lauded at Venice Film Festival and has received a lot of good reviews. So Evil Does Not Exist, the crux of it is it's an ecological, quietest, sort of slow burn drama, borderline thriller, which follows a rural / suburban Japanese community as they grapple with the fact that developers have their eye on a piece of land and development which would jeopardize the water system, which the town so heavily relies on, being as they are so connected to the landscape and so connected to their water sources. So it's a film about development, it's a film about resistance, it's a film about nature, ecology, and also personal ties.
Yeah, and it did do really well. I think it won something at the London Film Festival as well. You say slow burn, I think this is one of the biggest things about it is it's pacing. I think I read something that I shouldn't have, but when I was just trying to decide whether or not we were going to watch this film, you know, that it changes up like from scene to scene, and it does, but it's slow the whole time. It's very slow. It's a slow film. It's meditative in that way. And I really love, and some of these scenes are just absolutely beautiful and stunning. And I think the other thing to note, which I also heard from somebody, but I think it was something I picked up while watching it, was very much the point of view of the camera. So there's oftentimes the feeling that you're looking at the characters in the film as much as from natural perspective. The camera really sort of has a very interesting point of view. I mean, I think there's one very clear point when they find some wild wasabi, and it's as if we're looking at them looking straight into the camera, but it's like from the plant's point of view of some course. So I think really, really unique in terms of the way it was filmed. And I was really impressed by that. And but very slow film in a lot of ways.
Yeah, speaking of pacing, I saw someone said, this movie was a meeting that could have been an email. Which I don't, that's pretty harsh. I mean, so my initial thoughts going in initially at the beginning of the film were it's mesmerizing imagery and sound, visuals of nature. It's very clean and considered, and has a sort of virtuistic use of sound, a very mellow pacing, which I enjoyed. But it does make sense upon research that this film was a concert film. So it was meant to be a sort of like a visual vehicle for the soundtrack. It was initially a half an hour concert film by Aiko Ishibashi. But the music created by Aiko Ishibashi. And you can really feel that. I say this about so many films, like I get an inkling that it was a short film that has been drawn out. Yeah. And that is definitely one of those films where it seems like, yeah, they're just trying to fill the time and then didn't really know how to wrap up or to finish or to really take where to take the arc of the story, which I definitely feel was the case. I mean, there were so many parts of it that I loved. I did love the visualizations of nature. It was clean. It was calming. There was a lack of tension, but I mean that in the best way possible, in the sense that everything was quite measured. So when the developers send a sort of small PR team of two people who are sort of just hired PR people who I think were initially actors, which is a little bit of a strange term, maybe some kind of like a misunderstanding I had there or a translation error, I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, there are these two PR people that are sent to chair a consultation process with the townspeople. And it's quite a long drawn out process, but I'm not going to lie to you, I did really enjoy them really getting into the nitty gritty of like, you know, septic tank systems, like go there, sure. Let's hear it.
when I was reading reviews, there one guy gave it 2 stars. He said, "I gave this 2 stars and not 1 simply because I learned about where to put a septic tank."
Yeah.
But I did like the dialogue, but it was very slow. It was very polite. It did take a while. I wanted it to go places that it never got to, and then it went to a different place.
Oh yeah.
Slightly like I'd fallen asleep and had a strange nightmare, and then I woke up and then I left. Not knowing. Well,
I think we will have to get into like the end by not getting into the end. But I think going back to this pacing thing on the last show, we talked about Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, which was there were aspects of it which was like almost Godardian on how annoying something mm-hmm. has lasted for a period of time, like a long, long time, just kind of like make you have to wait through something over like that, nothing is happening. And I think this is in a very different way a slow film, like just even you sort of follow the two PR people back to town and listen to them talk about online dating or what they want to do with their life and stuff, and it just seems to like rest there for a really long time. Yeah. And you said like just sort of the careful sort of meditative way that the music is and the way things are shot, it really like it's a nice rest, so it's a different, totally different kind of pace than, but it takes a really long time to get through chopping wood or just getting water from a brook. So it's very interesting. And yeah, I wouldn't say I loved that, but I think I do like, as I said last time, I do like to be challenged in films for my attention. And I don't think I would have been able to do that very effectively if I hadn't been in the cinema for this one, but I was, so that's fine. But the ending was just a bit, I'm
looking around at each other in the screening I was at, everyone was just sort of like, what?
Yeah, I mean, when it went to black, I was like, this is the end. But I know this is the end, but I don't really, I don't really know what to say.
It was funny though, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I mean, because the first couple of scenes that begin to resolve the ending, you're just like, okay. And then a couple of others sort of in between, and you're just like, we're here now, we're at the end. It was just very jarring and sort of back and forth. I mean, I think that, so what I was about to say was that there are a lot of comedic moments in the film, but then obviously looking back, they're actually much more sinister probably than I was finding them initially, because I think it sort of wants to convince you that it's very harmless and it's very measured and it's very clean. It's very cool, like, how like an outsider or like a Westerner would say like the Japanese are just like a very like relaxed, just like much more polite, much more civil to each other. But then I think maybe that's kind of the point of it, having digested it, is sort of like ripping it away.
Yeah, and also the name, I think this is definitely maybe straight out of what Mark Kermode said, because I looked to find out what people thought about the ending. What is this name? And what there were critics who have said, whether or not that was Mark Kermode or not, was that there's such a, all of these characters are a lot more complex than they make out to be. I don't know. I don't really like I'm confused. Well,
they are. I'm sure they are. But I would have liked to have seen that. that would have been of interest to me. Like, I would have loved to get to know that. I just would have loved to know. I don't need everything answered, but this film, I feel like,
yeah,
was one of those ones where you just really can't help but feel a bit robbed of something more. And I don't know, like I say, reflecting on it, maybe you could take away more than I was initially giving it. But because I mean, for example, I do like the, I wasn't like kidding around when I said that I did enjoy the fact that we're talking about the septic tank. Like, I do enjoy that. And I think, yeah, like I like a little ecological film. We need more of them. And I think I enjoyed watching sort of a reasoned resistance against ill thought out development and damage, and the proffering of the adage that balance is key. It's not like we're anti development or anti like tourism or anything. It's about balance. So it's not one of those like polemic films that it could be, sort of like big developer fights angry townspeople. It was much more subtle and nuanced than that, but it did feel sort of like two different stories by the end. In a way, like I wanted to know the personal, what was going on with the family and the person and like the our main characters and then outside. I mean, yeah.
It was confusing. It was a confusing film. And I think primarily because the end was a bit of a shock and like left you questioning a lot. I mean, I'm with you with the septic tank stuff. I liked that scene a lot. In fact, that was probably one of my more favorite scenes. I love Frederick Weissman films. I love fly on the wall sort of conversations that happen, and you have to take the nuance from what everyone's saying and what's coming out. And I think they unpacked that enough in the following next scenes, or how that drove the characters to their next decisions, whether or not they were going to leave their job, or you know, is this glamping thing going to happen in the future, and how are they going to get that, you know, through. But you're right, then there was this whole family dynamic that with the daughter and the main character, and that kind of was left sort of mysterious, that he would just maybe leave or let the kid just kind of wander off, you know, like
it was with the mom. It's like, why you throw her in for like a hot second, then it's like, okay, so what was the point in that? Like, I don't understand. She's gone now. That's not relevant, I suppose, anymore.
There's just
to mean something, but I have no idea what it meant to allude to. Yeah, I try not to let something like that bother me in film, obviously. Like, I can let things sort of wash over me, but this I feel like was a bit flagrant.
It was. And not in like a David Lynch way, like, or specifically being mysterious about a box or something. But yeah, no, I'm very, very confused.
I mean, I read an interview that the director gave, and apparently he'd gone to see Kurosawa like give a lecture at a university or something, and apparently Kurosawa left the students with an idea, quote, shoot something that will surprise even yourself. And I feel like that's what the director did. They were just like, you know what, I'm gonna surprise myself. I mean, there is also, I think the director has also sort of alluded to it being more of a feeling reflected than anything else. So to give a long quote, when the director was asked if he thinks Japanese society is on the verge of a big shift, he thinks long and hard before replying, yes, I think very much so. I think a lot is changing and society is changing. I would say it's feeling like the beginning of a collapse. Even though the event that I'm depicting in my film is a small event, it's an incredibly sloppy plan that still gets pushed through and results in terrible consequences. I think the sense of moving forward is so far exceeding in a way that feels almost too late to recuperate. I don't think this film has a direct message, but it does reflect those feelings in a way. So
he doesn't think his film has a direct message.
No. Absolutely not.
Why would it?
Why bother? I mean,
yeah, no, it's strange. It's a strange film. But yeah,
which is fun, I guess. But like, I mean, there's also some sort of magical realism, which I wish there had been a little bit more of, because that's always fun. Yeah, but it's just sort of, it borders on the sort of like uncanny at points.
Yeah,
get a bit magical, but then doesn't follow through. But that's interesting, because it's nice to get a little sparkle of the magical and then have it fizzle into bleak reality, I suppose.
Totally. I don't really know what else to say. I mean, I do like the soundtrack. I thought the soundtrack was great. I did think it was beautiful. It left me with so many questions. So, and I guess that was the point.
I heard, just a side note, that I think the film was, an alternative title was meant to be The Gift. Meant to mean, there is in various cultures there's like a double meaning to the gift, as in it could be an insidious thing. So I suppose the glamping site is meant to be the gift, which is not, which is cursed. Then they went for evil does not exist. Why not?
But really, what the hell happened at the end? Like,
cynically, it made me feel good about potentially making films in the future, because there's obviously some like plot points that he wanted to follow through in, and was like, you know what, I just actually don't know how to pull that off. So what I'm gonna do is just
do that.
Just not do it. It's just not like, not film it. It's just like, make you assume what.
I don't get it, though. Nothing.
Okay, from the point of view, I do understand there's a lot of talk in the film from an ecological point of view, there's like a sort of like a warning. So one of the PR, the city, Tokyo born and bred PR people, is asking some pretty crazy questions about deer habits.
Yeah.
Because the parking site is meant to be on the deer, on a deer trail. So she's asking, are deer dangerous? Do deer attack people?
Only if it was gut shot.
Attack if it's gut shot, which is not really necessarily true unless it's a stag. But anyway, so I think it's obviously trying to hammer home the message of, like, you know, nature and people will fight back if they're, you know, pushed in a corner, or if you, you know, take away things that that facilitate their survival, they will become violent.
I caught that too. I was like, oh, she's in danger because the deer has been shot. But then it went to the strangling of the other man. And
what
then
God's name was going on.
The editor of this is just like, yeah, just all right, skip that whole bit and go straight to a strangling.
I want us to keep this in, but with like a spoiler alert ahead thing, because I just need to talk about this scene. I just really do. Like, so this girl is just looking at the deer, and you're wondering if the deer is gonna run over this child, or it's gonna be like, or she's gonna, like, you know, touch it and they're gonna evaporate into a cloud of sparkles or something. Or, and then you turn around and suddenly this man is choking the PR guy. But then that's not even the worst bit. It's the fact that the scene changes. And the girl's suddenly on the ground. He picks up the child. She has a nosebleed from being attacked by a deer, we presume. We don't see that. He carries the child off into the woods. And then this is the scene that gets me. You're watching the father running into the woods with the daughter to save her life. And then suddenly the guy he strangled just is staggering into the shot.
No.
Like, he didn't. Yeah. Is he dying? Did he die? I just honestly.
And then he falls back down again.
He falls down again. So maybe he died. But why did they have to? I just don't know. It's not that I'm like, oh, there was no precedent for that. It's just like the way it was done was so, like, I urge people to go and see this just so they know what we're talking about, because it is honestly one of those wild turns, even if you're looking at
this. The way that we got to that character, we just did not expect that to happen at all. It was shocking.
It's such an art movie thing to do, isn't it? It's like, oh, sod it, I feel like it's just getting away with it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just getting away with it. And it's just, I just don't think it really should get away
with it. when I left to walk home, I saw like posting a modern ad and it was like the strangest plot twist or something that like is on the quote. And you're just like, yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. So at the end of the interview that I just quoted about Kurosawa saying, shoot something that'll surprise even yourself. At the end of that interview, the director says, with a hint of a grin, I don't dare tell you which one surprised me. And I was just like, oh my God, please stop being so.
Evil Does Not Exist is currently out in cinemas right now.
When life's good, it's very, very good. When it's bad, it's horrid.
What do you do if your uncle says he's dying and you're the only person in the world that can look after him?
I'm just saying, I think it's OTT to buy four of everything.
Don't think like that.
Have you got any more of these big ones, please?
One, two, three. Four is OTT, be careful. But if you go six, seven, then you're buying too much stuff. Ooh!
That was my finger.
No, it wasn't.
You know, bossy uncle and
bossy nephew.
And bossy nephew, absolutely. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players.
What do you do when you're dragged into a mess that's exactly like the Shakespeare plays that he used to act in?
Which of you, shall we say, doth love us most?
I'm a bubbly person.
And he wants to give his kingdom away to a hot anthropology student he's fallen in love with.
He received £25,000 from you.
I'm intuitional about money. I don't really think of figures.
Everyone!
Why was I always the boring one, standing at the edge, never doing anything right?
Because everybody keeps saying, put him in a home.
I know they do.
And thank you God don't you want don't. To be in a home.
Or do I need to be in a home?
And then King Lear had his storm.
Death It's like going on the most wonderful holiday without any of the bother of packing.
So the final film we're going to review on the show is Much Ado About Dying. It's a documentary directed and filmed by Simon Chambers. And it, I believe, won Best Directing at IDFA in 2022. So it's a film about the director's uncle, David Gale. And he's getting quite old at this point in time. And Simon, the filmmaker and director, is in India and gets a call from his uncle to beg him to come back to the UK because he's not doing well. And basically needs a carer. So the rest of the film is really the relationship of Simon taking care of his uncle, the things that go through the process of, you know, end of life, the ups and downs of being a carer. And their relationship seems to have, you know, they seem to have a backstory of that relationship, but, you know, how it becomes such an important back and forth relationship of need and love as well. And David Gale, the older man, is a gay man who's not very well off. It's sort of a hoarder of sorts, but as have seemed to have a very lust for life, sometimes cantankerous and sometimes fairly you know, annoyed with life, but also seems to enjoy it as well. So it's a kind of combination of like conversation on the end of life and those who are around you and being a carer. So it was a film I wanted to see because I had seen the trailer and it, you know, there are these funny moments to it. Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what you think, Clara, of the film.
Sure, David. I mean, I feel annoyed about life right now. So I really loved this film. I mean, there's always a danger of a very personal film being it's kind of a bit smarmy, a bit self-aggrandizing, sort of like, yeah, here's my tale. And then, you know, centering yourself, putting yourself in a good light, also not being able to see your subject clearly in the editing process, especially. So, you know, maybe not being able to convey that person correctly, not having a really gripping story or a narrative, just sort of getting lost in that person's just day-to-day and their character. This is really a character study. This is about David himself. It doesn't fall victim to that at all. I think, considering that it is such a small and personal film, I think it's really brilliant and really universal. And quite complicated, considering that it is a very universal theme, you know, dying and love and relationships and fear and aging. I think there's a lot of layers to it. David is such an interesting character in and of himself, and I think he is I really don't want to have people like rolling their eyes at me saying this, but he is an inspiring person. I hear, like, you know, you don't want to be an inspiring old person, you know, the stereotype, but this is true of this man, I do have to say. It covers a lot of themes. So, for example, it covers what is performance initially, I think. So, I mean, the title is Much Ado About Dying, which is based on Much Ado About Nothing, which is a Shakespeare play, and it's also an allusion to the fact that David, the main character, really loves Shakespeare and he likes King Lear, and there's allusions to King Lear in the narrative of that. The story of King Lear is about a king who doesn't really know which members of his family's love he should trust, which ones are just cynical ploys for his kingdom, and then it's the king falls low, loses his kingdom, tries to recoup it. Basically, it's a tragedy. And there's a lot of reflections in this. So David is like a typical old lovey, the type of which we do not really see anymore, which is a great loss and a great tragedy in itself that we're losing these kind of people. So I think it's brilliant that that he is immortalized in this film, and a person like him is immortalized. He's performing throughout this film, which is brilliant. You can just tell he's like wants to act to the last moment, but then we do peel beneath that layer eventually. It's about eccentricity as well, in a non-mawkish way. It could so easily be like, oh, look at this gem, look at this old gem, you know, like one of those horrible feel-good stories that makes you just want to cringe and just sort of like curl up and die, really. Like, you know, in The Sun or The Daily Star, about like how old people are just like still walking a marathon and still doing things that you're not even doing right now, and you're like 30. But this is very realistic and real, but still quite whimsical and magical. It shows age in all its rot and its mildew and its poverty and clutter and its eccentricity that is almost intolerable at times. It shows family ties with all their warped, nonsensical networks and connections and shared overlapping memories and resentments and shared stories and reflections of each other in different parts, different members of your family. Which is what's so, such an interesting character point between David and the filmmaker himself, is that they're both gay men who've had very different experiences of being gay and their relationships and how they relate to other men and their sexuality, which is a really interesting study in and of itself. But yeah, I just really like David as a character. I think it was really gripping, actually. I was quite stunned at how I ended up sitting cross-legged, like 2 feet away from the TV, like crying by the end of it, looking at it. It's difficult to go into watching a film like this and to choose to watch a film like this, because you think to yourself, ironically, because we've just been talking about themes of civil war and like murder and like rape and revenge, but it's hard to go into a film like this, you know, wanting to see it because you know you're in to suffer a little bit emotionally. But I think there is so much to get from this film. So David, as he sort of deteriorates and he ages, he says he has no intention of dying. And I just love that sort of like, you know, rage against the dying of the light kind of attitude that David takes. And yeah, he makes you feel a little bit more sane as well. Not for the fact that he's so insane you feel like a normal person, but he's so normal, but in such a charming way. So for example, David is talking to himself. And then he says, oh, talking to yourself is the first sign of madness. Quite the contrary. And then the next scene, it just cuts to him flailing wildly to like cacophonous, like classical music, which is very much in keeping with like, you know, the madness of King Lear kind of situation. It's a really visceral film for anyone who's got, well, for anyone, I suppose. I was about to say for anyone who's got an aging parent or a family member or a friend. But I suppose it's for any human being, because there's just a certain horror to watching someone age and struggle and exist in grim living conditions. But yeah, I'm not gonna lie, it did make me feel a bit better about my life and my family, because I'm not there yet and I'm in this golden age that I need to be kind of appreciative of, that there is time before that moment when someone really depends on you. It's just a really interesting character study. It's just, especially from the point of view of looking at the risks, the interpersonal risks that older people face when they get older. So they're more easily exploited. There are people who can present themselves suddenly. They come out the woodwork, don't they? They come to be parasitic, and but then there's also the flip side of that in the story. There aren't just people who are trying to take advantage of David. There are also really good-natured people. So there are really that's where I think the what adds a little bit more color and a bit more drama to this is there are a lot of players in this film. It's not just about David and the filmmaker and his nephew and that relationship, but it's also the friends and the unexpected relationships which are forged later in David's life under circumstances that, you know, you never predict for yourself and he would never have predicted for himself, but we all hope may be possible, even at that age. There's so many good adages that David had, which I've actually remembered since the film. So at one point, David is just sort of pottering around and says to himself, oh, life is a game, but it's a serious game. And it's just these sort of like non-sayings. It's just like, but I find them really like amusing.
He has so many amazing lines and so much of a sense of humor, but also knew, like, I love how much he always knew what he wanted and was able to ask or was able to get and ask what he wanted, and because he chose to bring the right people around him as well, you know, like having his nephew there was somebody that he obviously trusted, even though they spat a little bit at each other as well. I like the thing that you said about it, eccentricity, because it does remind me a little bit of my obsession with Grey Gardens just the idea that, you know, putting somebody on screen who is performative. And I think that's the one thing that Grey Gardens does so well, and people look at it and kind of see, you know, hoarder, eccentric, you know, women who don't know how to clean a house or that kind of stuff, and then that brings it, which some of these similar kind of like things are coming out when you get older, you're not able to sort of, you know, take care of yourself in the same way, or the financial burden that is, you know, running a house, and it's insurmountable without asking for help. So I think those things are hard to watch, but also really powerful on screen. The only other thing I would note is that I was like, you know, having seen that it is distributed, it is getting distribution here, it's going to be out in cinemas. I also was looking at, having been at IDFA and around on documentary film festivals, you know, who and how you would fund a film when you're making a film like this. And what was really interesting in the credits is that it said this is completely self-funded. And he very specifically, utterly said, like, this is utterly, completely self-funded, as in he tried. Like, he tried to get this film made with money, but it didn't work. It didn't happen. I mean, he went through SDI's pitch as well. So he would have been chosen to be part of, you know, their pitch. It's not like everyone gets to pitch at those kinds of things. So it's interesting, though, that all of this obviously was a labor of love to make the film and to tell this story, but also probably a very hard film, as you said, to get people to come in to see, and to, because it's a hard film, it's a hard topic. We showed a film called Dead Good, which was about, you know, people who run, deal with the passing, your family's passing, but they're concerned about the moral aspects of that and doing it in the proper way and whatnot. And it was one of those moments where I was like, how are we going to sell this? How are we going to get people to come to this? There were a great deal of people who were really interested in this film, and I can see why.
I think that's what I would just like people to know, is that you should watch it. I would wholeheartedly recommend this film. And you don't even necessarily need to be in the mindset of feeling a bit like masochistic either. I think I have a friend, Alex, who runs, she's the head of This Meal Reminds Me, and she's done a lot of study at PhD level about death and dying and different cultural attitudes to death and dying, and she's run some events in Edinburgh. I would keep an eye out for those. She teams up with Let's Talk About Loss to do things a lot, and I think the big takeaway I've taken from those events and from speaking to her and also other people as we start to lose people as you age, is talking about it and facing it is all to the good. It's not one of those things that you can bury your head in the sand about and then, like, you know, you're gonna be that's all to the good for you and how you're gonna be able to feel. I think this film was really valuable for me. I think it was really educational almost, as well as really like heartrending and like captivating. I think it really, it made me understand the shared burden that we will all shoulder. I think the filmmaker is so honest when he says that he's being shouldered with responsibility of care that he did not ask for, and that he feels a level of resentment for that. And I find that really, really honest. And I really appreciate that. But I think David is just the perfect character for this. I completely see why the filmmaker saw like a golden opportunity in putting David to the fore of this conversation and this subject. Because there's moments where you just think, oh God, this can only end in, you know, this section will only end in tragedy, something terrible, which I suppose inevitably will. The film leaves no illusions about where it's going, but David always redeems it. He doesn't, for example, when he's taken into like a supported living place, but a supported living home for actors, which I love. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's a cool thing. I mean, lucky him. But anyway, so he's getting carted off to this supported living accommodation, and he's in the back of an ambulance. And instead of him looking really dour or like just put out, he has the most genuine and pure look of wonderment and awe on his face as he's passing by, I think it was a church or a graveyard. And I just think, I really hate myself for saying inspiring again, but I really do think it was so inspiring. It was so life-affirming. He's so grateful and so thankful and so often in utterly, utterly glimmering awe at the brilliance of life and art and people. And I think he brings a completely non-trite attitude and way of seeing and way of being in the world that I think is really refreshing. I think the tragedy and the comedy that is brought together is just really artfully done. I think the comedy and the tragedy in this are really jostling for attention. They're shoulder by shoulder, but it is that which makes up life, and that is why Greco tragedies are comedy and tragedy slung together.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you brought up the really good point of how, I mean, as someone who has dealt with recent loss in my family and my mom, who sort of had to shoulder the kind of similar situation of the of Simon, it's a difficult spot to be in, and you feel a sense of resentment for sure. And I think just bringing out these raw things from the filmmaker worked really well. But as you said, David, the character, is like, we couldn't have had this film would not have worked if it hadn't been for David being such a unique and inspiring, and somebody you can learn from. Like you said, inspiring is the word. At the beginning, I was a bit like, this is very dark, and maybe not the subject matter that I want to deal with this weekend. But it continued to get better, which is a very thing when you think what the point of the film was going to end up being is.
You're right. I didn't really think about it that way, but it is actually, now you look back on it, it does actually.
Yeah, for the first half hour, I was in a lot of distress. And then by the end, which I won't give too much away, but I just felt like I learned so much from David, as you said, and how to approach death, in a different way than I would have ever thought to. And I think that it got more and more bearable, because I think at the beginning, it was hard. Like, I needed to take a break for a second, for me. But also perhaps because of, maybe personal, experiences, if not, yeah. Mm.
There's a really lovely quote that I think just sums up David himself and his attitude and the film, the way that it ends up, or the sum of its parts make you feel, is that death is like going on the most wonderful holiday, but without the bother of packing.
Yeah.
But he says it in the most lovey accent, which you just can't help but be kind of comforted by. That's how I would sum up that film.
and also I would say, you brought this up about friends, like not just family but friends, and I think it's about the community that you build around you and your like your life's perspective on it. And I think it was really interesting to see who he met along the way, and how and who those people and how those people matter. So in some ways optimistic, because you don't have to feel alone at the end if you're as positive as David is, slightly cantankerous, but positive as David is, to look at the blessings that you have around you, or to appreciate life, like in the moments that you have, really lovely film, and glad that we were able to see it, and highly recommend people to see it if they find it online or in a cinema, hopefully near them as well. So that is our show for April, and it's been a weekend of intense emotions and a bit mysterious,
very much so.
A whole gamut of kinds of films, but what are you looking forward to? There's quite a lot of films coming out in the next couple weeks as well. Are you looking forward to anything coming out?
I'm not going to the cinema in the next week. I'm going to go outside.
Yeah.
Been in the cinema so much. I'm looking forward to that. This isn't a shameless plug, this is a genuine and I promise I'm not a shill, but I am keen to go to the next Cinetopia doc screening.
Well, I mentioned it before, but Cemetery of Cinema is definitely one of my favorite films that I saw last year, and I think one of the things that's really special about our screening is that we're going to get we've done a recorded Q&A with the filmmaker who's currently in Guinea, but it's a film that's so profound, it's so interesting, makes you think about archive and cinema and spaces and who tells the stories. I've never experienced a film that has had been so profound and yet so fun at the same time. So I think it's a nice in conversation with Kem's video, which was like wild and wacky and also smart and made you think, but but a different way. So I always say come to all of our film screenings, but like these last two, I really wanted people to come to because it's one of the opportunities that you'll not get to see a film like this, and it might not even get on a streaming. It's not going to get on Netflix. Maybe it will, but you know what I mean. It's definitely one to see in the cinema. And so I definitely really hope that people come and see that for sure. And so we're doing that. And all right. So thank you, Clara, for joining me for April, and we'll hopefully see you at Cemetery of Cinema then.
Yeah, indeed I will. I'll be there. It's an early birthday present to myself, so I will meet you there.
Oh, nice. Well, happy birthday, happy pre-birthday for you then. All right, well, thanks again, and enjoy the sun if it's still out.